This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. I'm Daniel Aiken, and for this episode, I met with Dr. Richard Solomon, Professor of Asian Languages and Literature at the University of Washington, and a leading figure in the field of early Buddhist studies. Richard's new book, The Buddhist Literature of Ancient Gandhara, is a fascinating look at the oldest Buddhist manuscripts ever to be uncovered. I spoke with Richard about the historical and religious context of these 2,000-year-old documents, which were found in modern-day Pakistan. Richard also talks about the ancient language of Gandhari, how it was decoded, and its particular significance in the formation of standardized Buddhist canons. Richard's work sheds new light on how we understand early Indian Buddhist traditions and their movement throughout Central and East Asia. I hope you enjoy the conversation. In 1994, you received these black and white photographs of an old manuscript, and that had been recently acquired by the British Library. And I was wondering what that day was like for you, and if you realized sort of instantly that you were possibly holding the oldest specimens of Buddhist texts extant.
Well, I didn't realize the dimensions of the entire subject at that time, but I did immediately realize that there was something, a major discovery. The first letter that I received about this was, it's not dated, and I don't remember exactly when, but this was from a guy, not the library, but someone who had seen these things and had some interest in them. And he said, this could be the find of the century. And so that stuck in my mind. And in a certain limited sense, in certain circles, it really is the find of the century. At that time, if I remember correctly, the first communication was just a photograph of one of the scrolls. So I didn't have any clear idea of the dimensions of the project, which then grew when I went to the British Library shortly after that. I learned that there are 28 of these scrolls. And since then, many, many more of them have come to light in various places. So now it's a matter of hundreds of scrolls. So I remember there was one day, not on my first trip, maybe my second or third trip, when I was really starting to get a sense of the dimensions of just this first collection at the British Library. And I remember thinking to myself, this is going to be tough. Maybe I'm going to need some help. So, and it turns out, you know, now we have an international project with several 8 to 10 people working, and we still only scratched the surface. So I only gradually came to realize the dimensions and the importance of all this. The basic reaction, you know, that this is something very important, that was clear right from the beginning.
And can you describe for us, when you actually saw them, what condition were they in? And this is birch bark scrolls, right?
Yeah. Well, by the time I got to London to see them, they'd already been unrolled and conserved, and so they were placed in between two sealed pieces of glass, sort of plate glass. So I didn't see the original scrolls. I saw photographs of them. The condition varied. Some of them were relatively intact. A lot of them were just scraps and bits and pieces of semi-disintegrated scrolls. Some of them are very problematic and still haven't really been worked out. But gradually, I and my colleagues developed various techniques for reconstituting these things, usually digitally through Photoshop and so forth. But at the time, it was a daunting sight, I'll say that. And I didn't realize the full dimensions of it, but I could see right off we had a big job.
So the scrolls had been placed in a clay pot,
right,
and were nearly 2,000 years old, is
right.
That right?
Right.
And how do we know? Do we radiocarbon date them?
Again, that's a little complicated. The dating is on two bases, two principles. One is radiocarbon dating, or C14 dating. The other is by analysis of the linguistic and paleographic features of the manuscript. So in respect to the latter one, we compare these the stage of the language and the spelling, the orthography, and so forth, with known datable documents, mostly inscriptions, because we already had a large number of Buddhist inscriptions from the Gandhara region, and those were all, not all, but as a general body, were datable to around the early AD or CE period. So that's on the one side. Radiocarbon dating is a little complicated, as I mentioned to you earlier this morning. And actually, this first known group, the British Library manuscripts, still haven't been carbon dated for various technical and administrative reasons. We're still trying to get them done. But in the meantime, other manuscripts of this type that have been discovered elsewhere have been tested by radiocarbon. I think we have 5 or 6 specimens. Again, it all works out within the same general period, from 1st century BC to probably 3rd century AD is the time span. And as far as the overall span, that's full confidence. Details, precise dates are a little more complicated, but we know we're in the right ballpark.
It's amazing. And then at this stage, Gandhara and the language is still incompletely known language, right? And I wanted you to tell the story about how you made your first big breakthrough in terms of deciphering some of these scrolls, and it had to do with the word for rhinoceros.
Yeah, the rhinoceros. So one of the manuscripts that I was focused on in my early work at the BL, what caught my eye in that, even though the manuscript itself was in horrible condition, it was totally decomposed, and it was just bits all in sort of random position, which gradually we had to work out where they belonged, but that took many months. But what I did notice is that on these fragments, there was a recurring line on many of the fragments of this manuscript. And in that recurring line, there was this word kagga. And at that time, I didn't quite realize what the significance of that was, but it was, when you're working with unknown documents, you look for patterns, you look for recurring words, and these are, typically the way you can break into it and get started, get some knowledge. So anyway, at that time, I was staying at a friend's house, a guy named Tom Lowenstein, who may be familiar because he's written books on Buddhism. He was student of mine many years ago in Seattle, and he studied Sanskrit and Pali with me, and we became permanent friends. So I was staying in his sitting room where he has his library, and one evening after I was looking at the manuscripts, I was just scanning his bookshelves, and there was a little paperback with a red cover, and the title was The Rhinoceros Horn and Other Sutras, I think was the title, by K.R. Norman. And immediately I realized that kagga resembles the word, the Sanskrit word for rhinoceros, kagga in Pali, kagga. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the Gandhari form is karga. The Pali form is kagga, the Sanskrit form is kadga, and those sound correspondences line up normally according to the rules of relationship of the sound systems, those three languages. So, I thought, okay, that must be the word for rhinoceros, and this rhinoceros horn is the name of one of the sutras in the suttas in the Suttanapatha, And it has this refrain line, wander alone like a rhinoceros. In Pali, it's a sutra about don't waste your time with playing around with other people. Just pay attention to your own business. So, you know, that night I said, okay, it must be that. And then the next morning I went to the BL and checked it out. And then the words surrounding this karga rhinoceros word fit in, corresponded normally to that refrain line. So that was the first identification, the first time where I clearly knew what the nature of the text was. And so that was the first breakthrough moment. And then, you know, at least I was beginning to have some sense of what the nature of this material was. And then, you know, fast forward 20-something years later, and here we are, still working on it, actually.
And it's still, you know, an incompletely known language, right? We know a lot more, yeah. But...
Yeah, the Gandhari language, before all this new material came, our knowledge was mostly based, as I mentioned before, on inscriptions, and we know now several hundred Buddhist inscriptions from Gandhara in this language, but that is not a sufficient body of material to give you a comprehensive knowledge of the language. I mean, these inscriptions are typically in quite formal, standardized forms of the same vocabulary. It was repeated in many texts, so our vocabulary base was relatively small. One manuscript in Gandhari previously known, this is the famous Khotan Dharmapada manuscript, which had been discovered more than 100 years ago and published by John Brough in 1962. So that was, you know, the one specimen of literary Gandhari that was known, and it was not clear what the status of that was. Was that a one-off, unique example, a unique instance in Buddhist literature, or was it the tip of the iceberg? And obviously it turns out to be the latter. So we, on the one hand, this was not, when we started bringing on these new manuscripts, it wasn't an unknown, undeciphered language. It was a partially known, partially attested language. But the vocabulary and forms and styles were, there was a huge amount of new stuff for us, and only gradually we've been getting a grip on it. And so even now, I mean, our knowledge of the language is not 100%, but it might be 90% or maybe even more than that. But there are still peculiarities and details and vocabulary that we don't understand. It's par for the course when you're working with an ancient language. And it's a very... in some ways, a very difficult language, even though, you know, we have a lot of supplementary knowledge. We know Pali, we know Sanskrit, they're related languages. But it's a peculiar language in that it's totally unstandardized. It's what I call language in the rough. The spelling is totally unstandardized, and there's the same word can be spelled 2, 3, 4, 5 different ways, even more in some cases, within the same manuscript. So there wasn't any dictionary, there wasn't any standard. And this is still a big problem, because sometimes you can have words that we know but are so disguised that you don't always recognize them. So it's a philological adventure.
I like that, philological adventure.
Yeah, story of my life.
So I want to go back in time and space to Gandhara. If we were to go to the place, where is that on today's map?
Well, it wouldn't be on the map today, but if it were, I'm sure that's what you meant. It's essentially, it's Gandhara proper is a small area. If you know the Peshawar in northern Pakistan, it's sort of the center of Gandhara, what in ancient times was called Gandhara, approximately between the modern Afghanistan border on the west and the Indus River on the east. And this is the river valley of the Peshawar River. So it's actually quite a small area, but critically located, sort of strategically located. And so it's sort of on the frontier line between what I'll just generally call the Indian world and the world of Iran and the world of Central Asia beyond. So in my work on this subject and in the new book, I make a distinction between Gandhara proper, which is that relatively small area that I just mentioned, and what I call Greater Gandhara, which is the much larger region which was under the sort of cultural influence of Gandhara in that time. And basically that means the areas in which Gandhari, the language of Gandhara, became the principal language in this period in question, the first two or three centuries of the Common Era.
So I think the Buddhas of Bamiyan got some coverage when the Taliban started destroying them, basically. So in relation to that area, where are we talking?
Bamiyan is what I would call part of Greater Gandhara. Bamiyan is quite far to the west of Gandhara proper, but it was in the within the area of influence of Gandhara in the period in question. This is a period when a series of kingdoms and empires were established mostly by immigrants or invaders from the west and from the north, particularly the Kushana dynasty from about the middle of the first century to the into the early fourth century was particularly influential and had regional, trans-regional influence, and that was part, not all of, but a part of the development of Greater Gandhara as a cultural region and linguistic area.
So you mentioned that in the Vedas, Gandhara is mentioned as a mysterious and foreign land. Do you think, during the Buddha's time, is that how it, imagining the Buddha, would he have imagined Gandhara as this mysterious and foreign land?
Yeah, it was probably, would have been on the very edge of his purview, if at all. Of course, in Gandhara itself, in ancient times, the local people were quite sure that the Buddha had been there, and mm-hmm. His footprints were here, and the place where he washed his robe was here, and so in Buddhist literature, in various parts of Buddhist literature, there are descriptions of the Buddha's travels and activities in Gandhara. But of course, from the point of view of a historical scholar of Buddhism, that's later pious fabrication. The Buddha's own territory was very far to the east and in northeastern India, and Gandhara would have been, if at all, in his consciousness, sort of on the outer fringe of the known world.
And then if we talk about languages during the time of the Buddha, or even writing, so it's unknown whether, in India at the Buddha's time, writing was happening, right? Is that a correct understanding?
Well, this was the subject of my talk last night at BU. There's a big controversy about really the origin and history of writing in early India. We do know that there was a form of writing in what we call proto-historic India going way back into the third millennium BC, the Indus Valley script, which is undeciphered and still completely mysterious. Then there was a period of well over 1,000 years in which we have no written artifacts. And it's only at the time of the of Ashoka, Emperor Ashoka in the 3rd century BC, that we have clearly datable, definite specimens of writing in the scripts, which then became the parent of all the later Indian scripts of the Indian world. So that's, you know, we have around, say, the middle of the 3rd century BC, we have clear specimens of writing. According to quite a few scholars believe that this form of writing that was the parent of the Indian scripts was invented by or during the reign of Ashoka, and that there was no writing before that. That has come under question recently. And there's some evidence or reasonable claims of specimens of writing going back to the early 3rd or even into the 4th century BC. But even then, you're not up to the time of the Buddha. So it appears that the Buddha lived in a culture where writing was not present. Or even if writing was present, he didn't use it. Mm-hmm. He and his followers didn't use it as a means of preserving texts. So, in effect, I think everyone agrees, early Buddhism was a purely oral tradition. Texts were preserved and transmitted by memory and recitation.
And then, if we think about, you know, what the Buddha might have spoken, we use this word Magadhi. You know, what do we know about Magadhi?
Yeah, well, there again, there's a controversy. Magadhi is the name of the language, the Prakrit dialect of northeastern India, of Magadha, which was the capital, political center of India, North India at the time. According to the Theravada tradition, they would say that, in fact, what we call Pali is identical with Magadhi. That is to say that they believe that Pali is the original language, the original form of the Buddha's teachings. The problem with that from a linguist's point of view is that Magadhi is an Eastern dialect, and we know this because we have other specimens of Magadhi, again, from inscriptions and from other literatures, and it has certain features that are very different from the features of Pali. I mean, just for example, in Indian languages, as in many languages, you have a relationship between the R and the L sound, and in real Magadhi, that is attested Magadhi, all the R's become L. So like Raja, king, becomes Laja in that dialect. But that's not a feature of Pali. Pali is an R dialect, so it would have Raja. So so there's a difference in point of view. And what most, I would say all, historical and philological Buddhist scholars would say, and I would say, that the original language of the Buddha is simply not known. Does not exist. That is to say, the original form of the Buddhavachana does not exist. Was not preserved. Why? Because it was never not written down. Because Buddhist scriptures weren't written until many centuries, or several centuries later. And in the meantime, it had been translated into all of the local dialects. And this goes back to a famous passage in the Vinaya, in the Vinayas, preserved in various languages, where two of the followers ask the Buddha, how should we teach the Dharma? And he says, in the Pali form, he says, Sakaya Niruttiya, which means in your own dialect. Mm-hmm. And this is understood as the prescription, Buddhist prescription, that his words were translatable. They were to be considered translatable. So you have a kind of a big contrast between where the Buddhist tradition goes versus in Islam or Judaism, where the original language is essential to the sacred texts. Buddhism is more like Christianity, a language, a religion of translation. Mm-hmm. So this apparently became the principle, and soon after the Buddha's lifetime, as Buddhism spread to various parts of India, it got translated into the local languages, and the original language form, Magadhi, simply is gone, and there's really no reason to hope that it would ever be recovered.
Mm-hmm. So that's true of the Pali canon as well. So the Buddha Vachana got translated into the Pali language as well.
Again, that would be the understanding of modern historians and philological scholars. That would not be the opinion of or point of view of traditional Theravadin Buddhists. Pali was originally probably a central north or north central Indian language that then became the vehicle of Buddhism as it spread into the south and into Sri Lanka.
So during the Buddha's time, was Sanskrit the lingua franca of spiritual writings? And so does this say something, the fact that the Buddha decided to keep his teachings in the local dialect, does this say something about his feelings around how he wanted his teachings to be preserved?
Well, that's a long story. I'll try to make it short. The two followers that I mentioned before who asked him about what language they should use, they apparently, although there is debate and disagreement about the nature of their statements, but they used a term which seemed to imply, should we transmit your teachings in Sanskrit? This was implied. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha's answer was no, do it in your own dialect, which seems to imply in the local dialect, the popular language of whatever you speak or whatever people speak, wherever you may be spreading the Dharma. So Sanskrit at that time, as you say, was associated with the Vedic or Brahmanical or what later becomes Hindu, the tradition, which the Buddha was reacting to, proposing an alternative for. And so that's why we have Buddhist scriptures in various local vernacular languages, Pali and particularly and now Gandhari. And I think it's safe to say that in antiquity, the Buddha's teachings were translated into several or possibly many other vernacular dialects, but that material is totally lost. If there were ever manuscripts, they are not preserved. But the irony of it is that later, shortly after the period that I'm talking about, or even beginning in that period, the Buddhist scriptures began to be translated into Sanskrit in North India. And the so-called northern tradition of Buddhism, of Indian Buddhism, by approximately the 5th century of the Common Era, has actually been reverted into Sanskrit, and most, if not all, of the scriptures were translated into Sanskrit. So there's a kind of a grand historical paradox, and I would say, to put it briefly, there was a cultural power that Sanskrit had that even the Buddhists could not resist. And because of the cachet, the status that it had, there was a push, a kind of a motivation, perhaps subconsciously or perhaps consciously on the part of Buddhists in that time, to render the scriptures into Sanskrit.
And so is it about this same time that the scriptures are being translated into Pali and Gandharan? Or is there a same sort of movement? Or does that development happen later? How do we understand that historically?
Well, let me talk about Gandhara, because that's my comfort zone. Buddhism first came to Gandhara probably in the time of Ashoka, the 3rd century BC. but it doesn't seem to have really taken root and become a really strong cultural sphere until about the first century BCE and into the first century CE. So that is probably the period at which this translation into Gandhari is taking place. So what's happening, as I kind of mentally reconstructed, is this a period when Buddhism is already settled to some extent in Gandhara, but there are going to be monks and teachers coming from other parts of India, other parts of North India, presumably, and they're bringing them with them their scriptures and texts. And at this point, probably already we're in the period of writing, so actual manuscripts, but also in their heads, in their memories. And then the old principle, Sakaya Nirutya, in your own dialect, is taking place in Gandhara. And so these translations these texts are rendered into Gandhari by the local Buddhists. And you can actually see this to some extent in the texts. For example, in a lot of the Gandhari manuscripts, the word for bhikkhu, Pali bhikkhu, Sanskrit bhikshu, is actually given, it's written as bhikkhu, even though the native pronunciation we know should have been bhikshu, more like the Sanskrit pronunciation. And that's clear, you know, artifact of translation, because that reflects the Eastern dialects. Mm-hmm. So as in all translations, there's always some remnants left over of the underlying language, and so those sorts of clues can tell us quite a bit about the process. The problem is that the source language is unknown. It's one of the local Buddhist dialects that hasn't been, which was not preserved. Okay. But we can have a general idea of what it would have looked like.
So it's thought that Ashoka may have brought Buddhism to Gandhara?
We have, of course, the inscriptions of Ashoka in two places in Gandhara, but those inscriptions are not explicitly Buddhist. You know, he had these sort of non-sectarian general audience statements of principles that he had inscribed all around India in his empire. But we know from Buddhist tradition itself that Ashoka was the great promoter of Buddhism, who turned it into a national religion of India or of his empire. But we don't have direct evidence of that from inscriptions and so forth. And for two centuries after Ashoka, Buddhist inscriptions are quite rare. There are just a handful of them in Gandhara. And then suddenly, right around the turn of the Common Era, it mushrooms and you get the enormous numbers of inscriptions.
So Ashoka, when Ashoka came to Gandhara, the monuments that were built, there could have been a specific Buddhist monument, but they went with the more secular monument.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I wasn't talking about monuments specifically. I was talking about inscriptions, the rock inscriptions. As far as the monuments, well, when you say monuments, I immediately think of stupas, and there are stupas all over the place in Gandhara, many of them still standing somewhat intact and extremely impressive and beautiful. The question is, and then it becomes an archaeological question of how old are these stupas, and that's a little complicated because stupas are typically have layers. So in this part of India and elsewhere in the Buddhist world, they'll start with a small stupa, and then sometime later someone will build another stupa around it and around it, and sometimes you get as many as five layers.
Wow.
So archaeologically, you know, dating a monument like that is pretty complicated. Without going into the details, there's at least one important Gandharan stupa whose inner core seems to be from the time of Ashoka. I say seems to be because the evidence is not conclusive, but you can make a case that Ashoka actually had what you refer to as monuments constructed in Gandhara. And of course, that's what he's famous for. Proverbially, he divided, he recovered the original eight relics of the Buddha, divided them into 84,000 and built 84,000 stupas all around India. So it's kind of a metaphor, a rhetorical metaphor for what seems to be historical and archaeological reality.
And there seems to be a connection between stupas and these scrolls in that some of the scrolls, they were put in clay pots and buried, some were placed in stupas. What do we think, why, what was the role of stupas at this time, and how did the text connect with that role?
Unfortunately, we don't have good, reliable or definite archaeological evidence of exactly where these scrolls came from and where and why they were deposited, but we have various clues that we can put together into what I feel hope is a reasonably convincing picture. And that I would describe as follows. We believe that many of these scrolls, maybe not all of them, but many of them were rolled up, put inside clay pots, and that these clay pots were buried either within stupas or in the area surrounding stupas. And that makes sense in according to Buddhist doctrine, as I understand it, because stupas are monuments containing relics, and the relics can be of various kinds. They can be actual physical body relics of the Buddha, or what the pious people would believe were relics of the body of the Buddha, or what are called associated objects, like the Buddha's bowl and so forth. And so these manuscripts are relics also. They're Dharma relics, and they're have the same meaning, I would say, as the bodily relics of the Buddha. They are pieces of the Dharma, so to speak. So it makes perfect sense, according to my understanding of Buddhist belief and practices in antiquity, makes perfect sense to have them installed in stupas or in the environment of stupas. And we also have some archaeological evidence that these things were buried in a way, in the same way that the relics of monks were buried. Of course, the monks' bodies were burned, and then there would be little pieces left over. Those are the body relics, the sharira, as they're called. They were, at least in some places we know, they were put inside clay pots and buried in or near a stupa. So I think there's a perfect analogy there between the remnants of the body of a monk and the remnants of a discarded, torn up old manuscript. They mean the same thing. They're both, the Sanskrit term is dharmadharas. Mm-hmm. They are bearers of the dharma, each in their own way, either in their heads or in their hands, so to speak. So it makes perfect sense for them to be treated in the same way and disposed in the same ceremonial way.
And it seems like the objects of refuge of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, it seems like these relics are associated of Buddha, relics of monks, relics of the texts seems to be associated with the stupas then, so that makes sense as well.
Yeah. There were many little surprises. There were no huge shockers. Someone asked me once, and I think I mentioned it in my new book, at a presentation in London, someone asked me, well, really the same question you're asking, but in a different term. He said, did you find a fifth noble truth? I said, no, but in a way, yes. Kind of ironically, there is a... one of the Abhidharma texts in the British Library collection, which is an extremely interesting and important doctrinal discussion. And in that text, actually, it actually mentions a fifth noble truth. but not in the way that one might expect. It's actually in a discussion of the issue of does everything exist, this central question in the debates between the Sarvastivadins and the other schools. So one of the opponents of the Sarvastivadin says, well, if you, and I'm grossly oversimplifying here, but he said, if everything exists, then there must be a fifth noble truth. And the Sarvastivadin says, no, it doesn't mean that. But I think that little episode is kind of typifies what is happening in this new material, is that we don't find anything that fundamentally undermines our general belief in what Buddhism is all about and what the basic doctrines and ideas are, but we find a lot of interesting new twists and presentations of that material. I like to quote Peter Skilling, who's a very important, influential international Buddhist scholar, and he talked about, in the context of these manuscripts, he talked about, it shows us the many Buddhisms that existed in antiquity, or it gives us some hint of the many Buddhisms that were there, meaning local varieties of Buddhism, which were within the, so to speak, the big tent, but had their local versions. I could give one other point of view on this. We, the people who were working on these manuscripts and struggling through understanding them, they tend to fall into two major categories. There are the known texts and the unknown texts. And by known, I mean like the Rhinoceros Sutra and many of the others, where we are finding a Gandhari version of a text which is known in other versions and in other languages, in Sanskrit, Pali, Chinese, occasionally Tibetan. So for instance, the Dharmapada, we have now three manuscripts of the Dharmapada. So that's familiar territory. So that's kind of the overall, the pan-Buddhist literature. On the other hand, we have texts, what we call unparalleled texts, which have no parallels in any of the other Buddhist languages. So that's kind of the local culture. But those tend to be of kind of the post-canonical or para-canonical literature. So for instance, we have Avadanas in the British Library Collection. We have a large series of Avadanas, which have been, most of which have been studied and published by my colleague Tim Lenz. And there you get a mixture of familiar stories, like there's a version of the Vesantara Jataka that everybody knows, and totally new, unparalleled, and clearly local material. So there are stories about interactions between the local Buddhist community and the local rulers, local kings, and occasionally people whom we know from historical sources, from inscriptions and coins and so forth. So there you get a really nice glimpse of the local nature of Gandharan Buddhism. But it's definitely within the realm, in terms of doctrine, belief, practice, it's well within the familiar area, familiar range of Buddhism.
So it's very interesting because it seems like there was these very localized Buddhism. So the Buddha taught in local dialect, but and then these teachings went into different, you know, traveled and went into different local languages. Mm-hmm. And then then this got written down in different languages as well, so different canons started to develop. But then if you take instances of the same suttas across different canons and different languages, they're not so different. It's more like an arrangement. They'd arrange differently or phrase differently. So in one way, like Skilling says, there's many Buddhisms. But in another way, since we didn't find a fifth noble truth, it's still the same family in a way. There's still one Buddhism in that sense. Is that fair?
I would say the doctrines, the ideas, the doctrines, and to a considerable extent the texts of this new literature are pretty much within the range of what people call mainstream Buddhism, to use a term that some scholars non-Mahayana. Mm-hmm. However, it turns out that's only part of the truth, because one of the other big issues is, well, what about Mahayana? Mm-hmm. And well, it turns out that mixed in with these texts, and I mean literally mixed in, like in the same pot or in the same box with all of these mainstream sutras, we find occasionally Mahayana sutras. Mm-hmm. And even not so occasionally, the latest count, I believe, is 10 definite examples of Mahayana sutras have been discovered, and all of them among groups, these several groups of mainstream sutras. So what is that all about, one might ask. So you have, for instance, Gandhari versions of the one of the Prajnaparamita sutras. We have Gandhari versions of sutras, Mahayana sutras preserved only in Chinese and or Tibetan. We have examples, at least two examples of Mahayana sutras which have no parallel in any of the other languages. And these are mixed in with mainstream sutras. It's clear that the Mahayana in some early but very distinctly recognizable shape was present in Gandhara in the first, second centuries AD, approximately, possibly even earlier. But we have the impression, and this has been proposed by other scholars on other grounds, I think particularly of Paul Harrison, with whom I work closely on these materials. It had already been posited that Mahayana was not distinct from mainstream Buddhism at this period as it became later on and became institutionally distinct in later Buddhism. Here we really get the impression, and I think of statements made by Chinese pilgrims to India, Xuanzang, I believe it was, said that he found so-called Hinayana, as he called them, monks and Mahayana Buddhists living together in the same monastery and apparently getting along.
Buddhism had been, it was in decline there, is that right?
Yeah, this was, of course, much later. This was in the early 7th century. There's been a big issue, you know, well, where does Mahayana come from? Do we want to go there? But textually and linguistically, until now, we knew of Mahayana sutras other than in translation, in non-Indian languages. They were virtually everything that was known was in Sanskrit. But what we're learning now is that was part of the later Sanskritization of the Buddhist canon in general that I referred to earlier. And what we know now is that there was an extensive literature of Mahayana sutras in Gandhari, and that the Sanskrit was not the original language. Was Gandhari the original language of the Mahayana sutras? Jury is still out on that and may be out for a long time. It's possible, it's also possible that these Gandhari Mahayana sutras were translated from some other Indian language. And that's something that, you know, may not ever be decided, because I wanted to say with regard to the Mahayana sutras and all of Gandhari literature, there's a lack of parallelism with the situation in other parts of India. I think, again, Peter Skelling, many Buddhisms and therefore many versions and many linguistic manifestations of the many sutras. So I think of what would have been going on at the same time, say, in central India or northeastern India or anywhere in India. What would the literate Buddhist literature have looked like in those places? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, who knows? And that will, I have to reluctantly but confidently say, we'll never know, because there's a matter of climate, of geography and climate. Manuscripts on organic materials, birch bark in the north, palm leaf in the most of the rest of India, simply cannot survive the monsoon climate for many centuries. The climate of Gandhara is somewhat more moderate, so it's not a coincidence the manuscripts survived there and didn't survive in the rest of India. I think there's really, frankly, no chance that manuscripts, Buddhist manuscripts of this antiquity, will ever be found in mainstream in India. But I'm sure that they existed at the same time. So those are, again, the many Buddhisms, but all but one or two of them are gone forever.
Yeah, it seems like the climate dictates which window we get to look in back into the past.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was, it's interesting, the question, where did Mahayana come from? And it seems like if Xuanzang's saying that in monasteries you had, for lack of a better word, Hinayana and Mahayana monks mixing together, you might, an equally valid question, because it's related, is where did Hinayana come from in a way? Because it seems like the picture we're starting to develop about what Buddhism was, or what these many Buddhisms were like, is quite different than what we previously thought. And is it true that early on, because we only had the Dhammapada as an example of a Gandharan text, that we were questioning whether Mahayana text might have existed in Gandharan? Is that, or did we always think that we would discover Mahayana Gandharan texts?
Well, that would depend who you ask, or who you would have asked 10 yep. years ago before this was becoming clear. The geographical origin of Mahayana has been an old issue, and most authorities have pointed to two areas. One was Gandhara, one was south in various parts of South India, particularly the Andhra region. And these are from references, direct and indirect, in certain Mahayana sutras have pointed in these directions. So in that regard, it's not surprising that we found Mahayana sutras in Gandhara. This does confirm theories that were put forth by, or guesses maybe, that had been previously put forth. But it doesn't tell us whether Mahayana was the center or the original center of Mahayana. Possibly, in fact, I would say likely, there were multiple centers of early development of Mahayana.
And we think these texts had an important influence on Chinese translations.
Yeah, yes. And that's really one of the most interesting, important big picture results that have come from this whole material and this whole the project of interpreting them. There was this something called the Gandhari hypothesis, theory which went back into the earlier part of the 20th century, and this was discussed. The term Gandhari hypothesis was put forward by Dan Boucher of Cornell University, who's also a player in all of this business. And the Gandhari hypothesis was the theory that the early Chinese Buddhist translations, translations of Buddhist texts into Chinese, so we're talking about the second and third centuries AD, that they were from archetypes not in Sanskrit, as had been assumed by everyone else, but in Gandhari. And the reason for this, again, it gets into linguistic and philological nitty-gritty, but basically it refers to how the Chinese translators would represent Indian words, or particularly proper names or untranslatable terms. So they'd not translate them into Chinese words, but write them with Chinese characters that approximated the pronunciation of the words as we know them. So the Gandhari hypothesis examined the way that that proper names and other technical untranslatable words were represented in rendered into Chinese, and how the Chinese characters that were chosen, how they reflected the pronunciation that they had received from the Indian teachers. And what was pointed out by these early proponents of the Gandhari hypothesis is that those, some, not all, but some of those renditions in some of the early Chinese texts sounded like the Gandhari version, pronunciation of the word or name rather than the Sanskrit word or name. So from that, there came the theory that the early translations were based directly or indirectly on Gandhari originals rather than Sanskrit. So that's one of the reasons that it's, in retrospect, it's not so surprising to find Mahayana and other texts, early texts in Gandhara. There was already a hint of that. So the implication of all this is that Gandhara was the source or the node from which Buddhism spread into Central Asia and then into China and into the rest of East Asia. And if you look at the map and understand the terrain, that's quite understandable. It's not the shortest route, but it's the most accessible route. The big picture result of all this is that the Gandhari hypothesis is not exactly proven because it's complicated and involves a lot of different literature and different translators and so forth. But the general idea that Gandhara was a, if not the major source of Buddhist literature that is, and it spread into East Asia is very strongly supported by the discovery of the rediscovery of Gandhari literature. So Gandhara really then becomes the jumping off point, the springboard, I've referred to it, as for the spread of Buddhism beyond India and into the rest of Central and East Asia.
And adds a whole nother dimension to why these texts are so important.
Yeah.
I'm wondering now, so what are you working on at the moment and where will your research take you next?
At the moment, I'm, well, taking a deep breath after finishing that book, which was a big job. I'm also on the verge of retiring from full-time teaching. I'll be, at least for the short term, reducing to part-time teaching and sorting out my my priorities for the future in terms of scholarly research and whatever else there is in life. I'm trying to remember what that is. Being a grandparent and a family man is I plan to do better with that. But I definitely plan to continue doing scholarly research. I don't think I can live without that. So I have in my head a list of four books and I don't know how many other smaller projects. I certainly a priority of mine is to continue editing at least one more and maybe several more manuscripts or groups of manuscripts from this whole Gandharan corpus. I also have the idea of putting together an anthology of Indian Buddhist inscriptions as a sort of historical baseline for the study of Indian Buddhism, which would include Gandhari material, but a lot of other pan-Indian material as well. So I'm finding my way, but I'm sure my ongoing research for the next X number of years will be not exclusive to, but will be pretty strongly focused on this Gandharan material.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Wisdom Podcast and share with us your expertise and knowledge and give us a glimpse back into the history of Buddhism and various languages. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to help.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Next on the Wisdom Podcast, I speak with Sonam Takjo, a former Tibetan monk with over 15 years of formal education in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Sonam was raised in Tibet just after the Cultural Revolution before escaping to India. He now teaches Indo-Tibetan Buddhist philosophy at the University of Tasmania, where he specializes in Madhyamaka ontology, epistemology, and ethics.
First 10 years of my life was between 70 and 80, exactly that period. It's just after Cultural Revolution, and every religious practice is banned. But I had one occasion that I remember, that's just before I left Tibet for India. I saw my parents. This is in the middle of night. My parents were doing something, right? When we were all go to bed, when I got 10 brothers and sisters, so it's a big family. We were all sleeping together, just in one, you know, one room. And that was all we can afford, I suppose. But I remember that my parents were doing something, like a huge sort of papers. That's how all I remembered. And I didn't realize what they were doing. When I was in Dalhousie for the first time, I went into this Tibetan temple. There I saw these leaves. I realized then what my parents were reading in the middle of night. The scripture, scrolls, right? This is picture. They could not read in front of kids in Tibet because we were totally innocent. We were totally ignorant. And we would go out and say, maybe, you know, reveal to the world what our parents are doing, religious practice.